the free, right to life and liberty. Open your eyes and you will see that America is still the land of the free.
Welcome to the Voice of Freedom, your national beacon of liberty. Now, here's your Voice of Freedom, Brent Johnson.
Edwin Vieira Jr. holds 4 degrees from Harvard, including a PhD and a Doctor of Jurisprudence. For over 30 years, he has been a practicing attorney, specializing in constitutional law. He has argued successfully before the Supreme Court, has written numerous articles and journals, and lectured throughout the country, and is co-author of the political novel Crashmaker, A Federal Affair, a not-so-fictional story of an engineered crash of the Federal Reserve System and the resultant upheaval that it causes. He is the author of a new book, Constitutional Homeland Security, and I'd like to welcome to the Voice of Freedom, Edwin Vieira Jr.
My pleasure being here.
The actual title of the book, folks, is Constitutional Homeland Security, Volume 1, The Nation in Arms. And at the very beginning of this book, he quotes Machiavelli, "To usurp supreme and absolute authority in a free state and subject it to tyranny, the people must have already become corrupt by gradual steps from generation to generation, and all states necessarily come to this, unless they are frequently reinvigorated by good examples and brought back by good laws to their first principles." I'd like to start by asking you the degree to which you see the United States of America having become corrupt.
Well, looking at it from the legal perspective, I would say the degree is significant. You can't quantify these things or put percentages on them. But if you look in terms of directions, if you will, if you look in terms of momentum, then we go back a long way in this. This didn't happen yesterday. Going back to the turn of the 20th century, really when the corruption set in fundamental ways, in terms of undermining constitutional controls, in terms of undermining federalism, in terms of shifting more and more power to the executive branch and away from Congress, so that instead of having self-government by the people or people's representatives, we have a system that is tending further and further towards the leader principle. It goes back a while, certainly in history, and it was gradual. Stepwise, it depended upon circumstances that served as rationalizations for each of the moves. Of course, we have the classic one now, the war rationalization, this war on global terrorism, for centralization of power in the government in Washington, and then for further centralization of that power in the executive branch. You add all those things up, I say that we're in a very difficult and troublesome position, which has many elements of great danger attached to it if something isn't done. And in fact, that's the reason that I started out on this particular book, Constitutional Homeland Security, and as you point out, it's Volume 1. I hope to be able to generate further volumes dealing with the subject in much more detail. This first volume is essentially an overview and a suggestion of what people in their local areas can do to try and redress some of the problems that we have. But I looked at this Homeland Security issue that arose primarily after 9/11. I sat back for a while and I said, this is an obvious area in which all sorts of people are going to start writing and talking about these problems, and lo and behold, nobody did. So I had to take the bit between my teeth and deal with this particular issue from A, the constitutional perspective, and B, from the perspective of popular self-government. What my book discusses is what the Constitution calls the militia of the several states. And here we're not talking, obviously, about people running around in the woods with camouflage outfits on and guns. We're talking about governmental institutions at the state level which have a constitutional existence and constitutional authority, constitutional responsibilities. If you go to the Second Amendment, what does it say? A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep their arms shall not be infringed. Today, we have lots of groups out there that are promoting what they call Second Amendment rights, and they focus on this second clause in the Second Amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. What was more interesting to me, and I think is in the long run more consequential, is that first clause. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state. Now, you stop right there. That is the only time in the Constitution or any of the amendments where the Founding Fathers ever said that anything in the Constitution was necessary. Not Congress, not the President, not the Supreme Court. None of those, and certainly none of the agencies that have been generated over the years in the executive branch, for instance, none of those is given the necessary aspect by the Constitution. Only a well-regulated militia being necessary to what? To the security of a free state. That's also an interesting point because the Founding Fathers were not interested in security in general. Obviously, you can have security in a maximum security prison. By hypothesis, that's a very secure place.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, it has been said that if you really want security, go to prison.
All right. So you can have that kind of security. But that's not the kind of security the Founding Fathers had in mind, and that's not the kind of security for which they provided necessary tools in the Constitution. It was the security of a free state. And a free state was the type of state that had a constitutional limited government such as they gave us. So we look at that phrase, the well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, and that tells us the basis of any kind of homeland security situation that we want to find ourselves in. Now, if we go back to the original Constitution, it's interesting that the original Constitution also provides for militia. It doesn't create them. Interestingly enough, the militia of the several states, which is what the Constitution calls these establishments, are not created by the Constitution. They're simply recognized as being there, in the same way the Constitution recognizes the states as being there. It doesn't create them.
I happen to agree with you, by the way. I think the first clause in the Second Amendment is the key. I have spent a lot of time and also no small amount of writing on the subject. Most significantly, I think, is the term well-regulated. Today, anything having to do with government, the word regulated is taken to mean, well, we control every aspect of this. But back in 1791, the term well-regulated simply meant in good working order, functional, as opposed to regulated by government. So I definitely resonate to the idea that the first clause is the key.
Well, we can come back to that in just a moment, but go into the body of the Constitution. And as I said, the terminology is the militia of the several states, which tells us something right away, that these institutions are to be state institutions. There is no such thing as the militia of the United States. It doesn't exist in the Constitution. Congress is given certain authority with respect to the militia, to organize, arm, and discipline the militia and govern such part of them as come into the actual service of the United States. And that, of course, makes sense. If the militia are called up to serve national purposes, then the governing rules would be ones that apply to all of them. The militia from New York is not going to have different rules from the militia of Maryland, for instance. But Congress's authority is to organize, arm, and discipline. In other words, to get these institutions well-regulated on an equal basis. And then secondly, the Constitution gives to the militia a responsibility, which to my mind is really the definition of homeland security. Militia can be called forth by Congress for three reasons. Number one, to execute the laws of the Union. Number two, to suppress insurrections. And number three, to repel invasions. And if you stopped right there, you'd have a pretty darn good definition of homeland security that probably 99.9% of the people in this country would accept and understand.
Co-written by General Patton, something called the Swiss Report, which was a study of the system in Switzerland, where they have citizen militia throughout the country. They're well-trained. Depending on how old they are trained in certain functions, and they're trained to, in the event of an invasion, blow up the bridges and fight a war to preserve their principles. And this report went down with Korean Flight 007. But this report was supposed to be presented to Congress as almost like a formula for how we could secure our own country. If all the people knew that they were responsible, not some arbitrary bureaucrat, but that they themselves were responsible for the health and well-being of their country, that would indeed be homeland security.
Well, of course, that's the key. If you go and look at the Constitution from a structural perspective, kind of an architectural perspective.
By the way, Switzerland was never invaded by Hitler, and most historians believe that's the reason why. It would have been too costly.
Now, of course, the Swiss system is a militia system which goes way back in history. It goes way back into the Middle Ages, really. The reason that the Swiss are so far ahead of us in that is because, of course, in this country, from the turn of the 20th century on, the real constitutional militia were essentially allowed to wither on the vine, and the National Guard was established as a huge reserve for the armed forces, the army initially, supposedly to take the place of the militia. Now, of course, you have a constitutional problem with that. Leave that all aside. But the point you make is absolutely clear when you come back to the architecture of the Constitution and you look at what I would call the pillars of the structure. You have we the people as the earthly sovereigns, we the people to ordain and establish his constitutions as the preamble. That's the source. Then, of course, we have we the people as the electors. It's never mentioned that way in the Constitution, but the Constitution refers all the time to elections, and we know who's going to be involved in voting, so we have we the people as the electorate. Then, of course, we have Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court of the judiciary system at the national level, and we have the states at the state level, and we have these other institutions, which most people never seem to realize are at the same level of the institutions I've already mentioned. The Constitution treats them that way. The militia of the several states. And the militia of the several states are, of course, whom? We the people in another capacity. We the people are the sovereigns. We the people are the electors. The states, Congress, President, and the Supreme Court are essentially our representatives or agents to perform our will. And then the final power in the structure, the ultimate power in the structure, as Mao Zedong said, all political power goes out of the barrel of a gun, which in a sense is correct, and instrumentally at least. If you don't have the power, you're going to be controlled or governed by someone else. The ultimate power, the power of the sword, as classical political philosophers would put it, resides in we the people again in the form of the militia of the several states. So those are the fundamental structures. If we look at our system today, we find that one of those pillars is not there. The we the people in the militia of the several states, oh, there are some states that have kind of truncated residual militias, but the reality is the type of structure the Constitution foresees as being there is not there. Now, I ask you a very simple question. You go to an architect, and the architect gives you a set of blueprints, and here are these 6-7 pillars in his blueprints, and you say to the architect, well, let's just take this one out. I think he's going to tell you, no, you can't take that one out. It's there for a reason. I didn't put that in simply for cosmetic purposes. It's a structural element. If you take that out, you will weaken the system, and the system may, in fact, over time, collapse. And that's exactly the problem that we are facing now in two senses. Number one, we don't have the militia structure that we should have, so we don't have the level of organization and training and protection that, say, the Swiss do, in fact, have. And they've shown us it can be done, obviously, with a much smaller population, much less wealthy country. And then on the other side, we have people in official positions all the way up to the White House who are trying to jam down our throats a so-called homeland security system based on a centralized bureaucratic police state model, which is the exact contrary of everything the Constitution has to say about security. The Second Amendment says security of a free state is the thing we want, not police state security, not prison-type security.
That is the perfect point. Security at the expense of liberty isn't worth it. It's just not worth the price. You have Cheney coming out saying, I'm not subject to the executive branch of government or any oversight. You got Bush making laws for himself. You've got a court system that is unquestionably not functioning the way it was intended to function. And you've got a bunch of legislators who are sitting around playing politics. In the end, all three branches are supporting the status quo. But I believe that the reason they have gotten so far from the original intent is the lack of that one pillar that you mentioned. And that is the pillar of, what are you going to do about it if we don't comply with the Constitution? You see, there really is no consequence to what these people are doing. And I believe you have hit it right on the nail. It's because there are no more effective militias in the several states.
Well, I think that's right, and I don't give myself a tremendous amount of credit for this. It's something that anyone who looks at the history of the subject and reads the Constitution and tries to put his mind into the minds of the framers and the context in which they lived will see that, well, this is the way it was meant to work, and this is the consequence if you don't follow that plan. And the point I try to make to people is, well, Americans are electors, and every 2 years or 4 years or 6 years they go to the polls, And in theory, that's supposed to have some beneficial effect because the good politicians will get in, if there are any, and the bad politicians will be removed. But what happens during those 2 years or those 4 years or those 6 years? Between elections, where is the self-governing aspect of the system if people are not organized in some institutional structures that have legal authority? You can't do this with private groups, obviously, that have legal and constitutional authority that can make their weight felt in some way in the process between elections. I'm not talking here about people arming themselves in a militia and going out in the streets and so forth and so on. I mean, that's kind of plural thinking.
Let me ask you a question before we get too far off point. All over the world, there are governments that almost unanimously have provisions for no confidence votes. If in the middle of a presidential term or a prime minister's term, he's behaving against the interests of the country, they have provisions in their respective constitutions to remove him. Not so much as impeachment, but through a simple no-confidence vote. Yet, we have nothing of that sort. What have you found was the intent as to how we are supposed to deal with those times between the elections when our elected officials simply don't do what we want them to do?
Well, I think the original anticipation, given that the Founding Fathers themselves were all pretty much on the same wavelength type of government that they wanted to have, was that there would be checks and balances within the governmental level. If Congress went too far in something, of course, you had the veto. If the president went too far, Congress could cut off funding or dissolve agencies or create new agencies or whatever. I mean, Congress has legislative supremacy in the constitutional structure. The courts, if they looked at criminal statutes, let's say, that they found to be egregious, they could simply refuse to enforce them. These prosecutions might come forward, but every indictment would be dismissed. And then obviously behind all of that you had the jury system, which if it got so far, supposedly the jurors were going to look at these egregious acts and refuse to enforce the laws. Now what happens if all that broke down? Of course, we have the impeachment power, which is a rather cumbersome one and difficult to get into operation, let alone to carry to fruition. Then the point that I'd like to make now is, we don't have people in this country who are paying attention to self-government other than at the infrequent times that they go to the polls to vote. Oh, some of them will call their legislators and lobby with respect to a bill here and there if they're really incensed by something such as the illegal immigration bill that they tried to put through recently, the amnesty bill they tried to put through recently. But that's something that's adventitious, it's ad hoc, you have to organize a lot of people and really stir them up. There's no institutional structure at the present time. But the Constitution gives us an institutional structure. It is the militia. So let me give you an example. Let's say that we had a militia organized in each state the way the Constitution provides, which would be essentially every able-bodied adult male and female at least would be on the rolls. What functions they would perform would depend, and it would be different. I mean, the Swiss give us a good example of how they can differentiate in terms of functions by age, by sex, by what have you. But they'd all be at least on the rolls, and there would be regular meetings and communications within that system. So let's assume that Congress and the President and, for whatever reason, the courts begin to go off the deep end into something, and it's now 2 years to the next congressional election, 4 years to the next presidential election. My suggestion would be that very quickly on, people in the militia in each state would exercise their self-governmental powers and just send a remonstrance to Congress. We don't want this bill passed, or we want this bill amended or repealed. And if not, we have some perfectly nonviolent consequences that will follow. We shut the country down for a week. We've got 100 million people in this organization. We'll shut the country down for a week. You don't want that? A month, all right? It would be essentially the nonviolent political control of the country simply because such huge numbers of people, and I'm not talking about people who are simply in private employment. Franklin said, I've given you a republic if you can keep it. And Adams said, oh, and by the way, this kind of government can only be maintained by a moral people.
That is so true. If you undermine the morals, you undermine the strength of the people who, after all, are intended to make state militias.
Well, I think that's true. But these things work in tandem. If you break down the institutional structure first, which of course is what they did, and I don't think they did it really intentionally to subvert the country, they did it for another reason. They did it because they wanted to engage in imperialistic adventures And the Attorney General of the United States had told them at the turn of the 20th century that it was unconstitutional to call the militia up to go into foreign wars. So they had to create this huge body of reserve troops called the National Guard to enable them to engage in foreign adventures. But leave that aside for the moment. The institutional structure was allowed to wither, and in most states it just isn't there. And as a result, you didn't have a focus where people could see themselves actually exercising some aspect of self-government. And when they saw these immoral inroads, which, as far as I'm concerned, were all planned by various special interest groups in this country, this was not something that sort of came at us from Mars. It was done by real cultural subversion. When that type of stuff began to appear, if people had been organized and understood their responsibilities for self-government and understood that self-government could function only in a society that maintained a high moral tone, that business would have been stopped right then and there. Now, I look at it from something of a practical point of view, and I say, we're in deep trouble. And again, I can't quantify it, but take the last 10 years, it's been increasing and accelerating. It's the acceleration of the process that's most frightening. What can we do? Well, changing the moral tone of this country may be difficult because we really don't have a focus. We don't have a handle on the problem, institutional handle on the problem. But I think changing the institutional structure or conforming the institutional structure to what the Constitution provides and requires may be a little easier. Number one, because it's there in the Constitution. This isn't something that I invented or you invented. It's there. Number two, it's fairly easy to point out to people that it's a basic structural element. I don't think you need a Harvard education to be able to read the Constitution and see that. Thirdly, and most importantly to me, which is why I got off on this issue, with all of the hoopla, because a lot of it's exaggerated, but this Homeland Security propaganda that's out there, everyone's attention has been drawn to this problem. And watching what's going on in Washington, I think a very large percentage of the population has its attention drawn to the real dangers that lurk in what's going on. I don't care whether you're a member of the ACLU or whether you're a real constitutionalist. You look at what's going on in the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm not blaming Mr. Chertoff in particular. Almost anyone that would be put into that position, I think, would behave the same way because that's just a bureaucratic mindset. You take a look at that thing, and you have to see in that structure a mirror image, if you will, of some kind of East European communist police state from the 1950s.
Even the term homeland goes back to Hitler.
That's right, and that terminology, in fact, in my book, I use it in quotation marks.
Because it's in quotation marks, I think it works very, very well.
That's why I use it, because that's the term they've given us. All right, fine. You gave us that term, fine. We'll work within that context. But you have to have constitutional Homeland Security, not Bush Homeland Security, Cheney Homeland Security, Chertoff, whoever it is. It may be Mrs. Clinton in a couple of years. This is not what we want. This is not what the Constitution provides. It's not what the Constitution allows.
I have a question for you as a legal person, as an attorney. I want to know whether you think my characterization is accurate. Now, the way I see it, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, period. Now, you have people in government who have and continue to circumvent the Constitution. And by extrapolation, you have many people. For example, there was no declaration of war. There is no constitutional provision for passing a resolution to give that authority to the president. Going to war in Iraq is an illegal invasion. As an illegal invasion, it would seem to me that not only the president and vice president, but all of the soldiers are engaging in effectively a criminal act. And I characterize them as criminals as a result.
Declaration of Independence tells us that governments can exercise only just powers. The concept of a just war was well understood in those days, certainly it's still well understood if you read the literature. And the first element of a just war is that you're not an aggressor. You can't attack somebody else unjustifiably. That's not a just war. Number two, a just war has to be declared by what's called competent authority. Even though you might have a reason, you still have to have the competent authority in your country declare this war. So the classic example to my mind, using a president as an example who did a lot of things that were clearly unconstitutional and knew he was doing things unconstitutionally. World War II, the Japanese so-called sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, leave that aside for the moment, but the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Roosevelt still had to go to Congress to ask for a declaration of war, right? He didn't simply say, well, we've been attacked, now I can do anything I want. Wrong. Even Roosevelt knew he had to go to Congress, he had to get a declaration of war. Well, he got it, fine. Constitutional problems set aside there. We look at the Iraqi situation. Not only was there no declaration of war, probably because there was certainly no justification, Saddam Hussein hadn't done anything to us, but Congress didn't declare war. It could have been an unjust war even if Congress declared it. But clearly it's an unjust war if Congress didn't declare it. A just war has to meet about five different criteria. The first one is you essentially have to be attacked. And the second one is you have to have competent authority within your political structure to declare the war. And we didn't have either one of those. Ergo, what we're dealing with here is essentially a war of aggression. Now I bring you back to Nuremberg. The interesting thing about Nuremberg was that the foundational crime that was alleged against the Nazis was conspiring to start and then starting wars of aggression. This was the whole basis of the legal brief against the Nazi regime. And in fact, as a multi-volume set that was put out by the Government Printing Office, official publication of the U.S. government at the end of the war, which collects all sorts of documents related to the whole problem. And its title is Nazi Conspiracy and Aggression. That was the theory, that the Nazis, Hitler and his group, had conspired to take over the German government in order to engage in war of aggression, and then they engaged in those wars of aggression. Now, I go one step further with the Nazis. Hitler's justification, such as it was, for attacking the Soviet Union, with which he had a non-aggression treaty, by the way, was preemptive war. He claimed that he had to attack the Soviet Union because he was afraid the Soviet Union was going to attack Nazi Germany.
This sounds like the George W. Bush playbook.
Yeah, we've seen it all laid out. And there was no question that certainly if it was a surprise to the Nazis that aggressive war was an international crime, it can't be a surprise after Nuremberg. Because obviously at Nuremberg, they hanged people for those crimes. Now, I can lay aside all the problems involved with Nuremberg procedurally and so forth and so on. But I think that basic concept of an unjust war, a war of aggression, being some kind of international criminal act, was not something that should even have surprised the Nazis. And it certainly should surprise no one today. Now, the difficulty you have with the common soldier, I mean, obviously the leaders are responsible. The ones who make the decisions are responsible. Common soldiers in our country are given a playbook, if you will, which says that they do not have to and that they should not follow any unlawful order. They're told to kill civilians, if they're told to steal property, etc. You can run out a list of obvious illegal orders. They're not to follow those. And it would follow from that that if they're told to engage in a war of aggression, they're not to do that. They just put their guns down and refuse to march. The difficulty is, of course, the way discipline is enforced in the armed forces, that there really is not a great deal of practice in soldiers, Marines, airmen, or whatever, going through these procedures of determining for themselves whether particular orders are or are not valid.
But, as you mentioned Nuremberg, that's where it was established that I'm just following orders cannot be a justification. When you look at how many people's lives have been destroyed or disrupted over the last 4 years alone since the invasion, from a justice's blind perspective, these troops are responsible for that. If you're going to apply justice across the board, it would seem to me that not only the troops, but the president and vice president are all criminals. And if you regard them as criminals, the solutions take on a different framework.
Well, if we had these structures in place, I would find it difficult to imagine that the situation would have gotten as far as it has, because I seriously doubt whether the House of Representatives in Congress would have given Mr. Bush this open-ended so-called authority to use force. Well, let's assume that he did. Let's assume that it really thing gets out of line, and that by some happenstance of fate, the absolute wrong people get in the majority in House and Senate, and they're in the White House, and so they start this. Well, I come back to the nonviolent solution. And the nonviolent solution, of course, is that the militia throughout the states say, no, we're not going to participate in this. We're going to close down the ports. We're going to go and seal off the military bases. The military people aren't going to shoot at us, and we're not going to shoot at them. But we're going to take effective nonviolent action to close this down. And then we're going to demand certain responses from Congress. Now, your grave difficulty here, of course, is there is only full 2 years to the next election. What happens in between? You have to face that kind of a problem with trepidation. Are you going to have some bodies within the executive branch, the attorney general, for instance, indict and arrest the president? He has to be impeached first, impeach him first, get him out of office, and then he can be indicted. The Constitution foresees that sequence. It mentions that sequence. Look at the situation you have now with the Democrats in control of Congress. Why aren't they proceeding?
That's a great question also, because politics is playing more of a role than the will of the people. These people in Congress were put there, at least in the House, to represent the will of the people, not right. their own political interests. So clearly, what Congress is or is not doing is, from a constitutional standpoint, not what it was intended for.
It's certainly not promoting the common defense and the general welfare with emphasis on the words common and general. It's promoting the interests of some special interests, including the Congress people themselves. Well, I mean, I take a look at the situation there now. They certainly don't need to necessarily impeach Bush and Cheney. They gave the administration this force authority. Repeal it. And not only that, but pass a resolution saying that the use of any American troops in Iraq, name whatever countries you want, is unlawful. Let's remember, it's Congress that has the authority, not the president. All this commander-in-chief stuff is nonsense. The Constitution makes it very clear that Congress has the power to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. That's an exact quote. He's always the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, but he's always subject to the rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces made by Congress.
You don't apply the service clause there?
No, because that ties in. The parallel is the power of Congress to provide for governing the militia as may be employed in the service of the United States. That's the parallel.
I had always thought that the president is intended to be primarily a civilian post. And he only becomes a military person when there is a military action, i.e. war, declared by Congress.
In a more straightforward fashion, he's commander-in-chief because there are lots of things that go on in the Army and the Navy in peacetime. So it's not something that requires war to be declared. But he is commander-in-chief subject to the rules for governance of the armed forces set by Congress. He doesn't set the rules. So if Congress passes rules and regulations for the governance of the Army and Navy and says, on no circumstances will the Army and Navy be used outside a 200-mile limit of the United States, that's the end of the discussion. Commander-in-Chief doesn't give the President the power to override the rules that have been established by Congress. And if you go back historically, you can see this very clearly. Under the English system, which Founding Fathers, of course, were under during the colonial period, the king had essentially all military power in his own person. He was the commander-in-chief of the army and the navy and the militia, and he made the rules and regulations, and he declared war and peace, and he had all of that authority. Parliament could raise money, but that was essentially the limit to it. That was their check and balance, and not a very strong one at that. Constitution comes along and says, yes, the president shall be commander-in-chief. But the power to declare war, which used to be the king's, goes to Congress. The power to make rules for the government regulation of the land and naval forces, used to be the king's, goes to Congress. The power to provide for governing the militia, used to be the king's, goes to Congress. All of the powers that really are substantive, that tell us how those bodies are going to be used, are congressional powers, not presidential powers. So if the president comes to us and says, well, I'm commander-in-chief, never I can do this, that, and the other thing, the first question is, well, where is that in a statute? Show me the statute that allows you to do that. If there's no statute, you can't do it. Commander-in-chief doesn't give you anything more than the title. And maybe you can wear the hat, and they'll salute you. But if the rules and regulations promulgated by Congress tell you you can only go to this point, that's as far as you can go. And if you step one angstrom unit over that line, you're in violation of the Constitution, and you may be subject to impeachment and criminal prosecution. You have no more power over that line than a bag woman on the streets of New York City.
That brings us to the really tough question. We have a situation today where the president wantonly disregards any congressional oversight, and where the Congress refuses, presumably for its own political reasons, to do anything about it, thereby subjecting the American people to tyranny. We do not have the militias of the several states as they are supposed to be. We cannot assume that example that we gave earlier. What if it was in place? Right. It isn't in place. But the tyranny, the injustice, the spitting on the Constitution, the goddamn piece of paper, as Bush put it in one meeting, which still astonishes me, we have all of those problems. The question now is, how do we deal with this? How do we recreate our republic the way it's supposed to be? It's wonderful what you've put into this book, but how do we actually make it happen?
They've given us the entree in fear. First, the paranoia they've created over the global war on terrorism. And then the honest fear that they've generated in a lot of people over what they're doing in the Homeland Security Department in Washington and all the tentacles that are reaching down into every state and local police force. I mean, you don't have to be too bright to see the extent to which our local and state police forces, everywhere that I've ever been and looked, are being paramilitarized and getting all sorts of equipment that would have done very well for the troops fighting in the Battle of Stalingrad.
Oh, no kidding. I've seen in rural sheriffs' backyards, fully armored vehicles, tanks. Right. Very, very rural sheriff. He really needs that.
Well, if somebody thinks he's going to need it. And I think a lot of people are looking at that situation and saying, what's the ultimate purpose behind this? What's the ulterior motive? These things are not needed now. Someone in Washington is foreseeing a situation where these things are going to be needed. And needed against whom? Not against armies of Arab Marines invading this country. That's an absurdity. These things are going to be used, intended to be used, against the American people themselves. So I think a lot of people are getting a very justifiable fear, and as a result of that, it usually takes fear to get people off their couches and do something. They will be amenable to taking some real action. And what I've tried to propose in book Constitutional Homeland Security, Volume 1, is organization of Americans in their own local communities to essentially educate and reorganize themselves in order to promote legislation in the states that will, what I call, revitalize, reorganize, restructure the militias in those states as the Constitution requires them to be structured. And what I'm hoping is that this will happen in just one state. I'd like it to be one of the original 13 because there's a tremendous amount of historical material that can be used and I'm using in the books that I'm working on now to justify this for over 150 years worth of colonial experience. But if it happens in Wyoming or if it happens in Arizona, that's fine too. It has to happen somewhere. And I think once it happens somewhere, it'll begin to spread like oil on water because people will see, A, that it can be done, and B, what the potential value of it is. And I think we have to be incremental in this. Americans have sat on their hands for a long time, and dangerous situations have developed. And the people in Congress, and certainly the ones running for the presidency, seem to think that they are not only superior to the people, but antagonistic to the people. They really don't give a damn, if you'll excuse the law of French, about the people of this country. They respond to other constituencies, whatever those may be. So I don't know that we can deal with them. You can't get control of Congress. You can't get control of the presidency. Well, you know, Ron Paul is out there, but is it likely that he's going to, A, get the nomination, or B, if he gets the nomination, be elected, or C, not be assassinated if it looks as if he's going to be elected? We always have to think of the lone gunman. So there we have those problems. We can't get control of the superstructure, of the eye of the pyramid, if you will, looking at the $1 bill. We can't get control of the eye of the pyramid. But in a sense, we don't want control of the eye of the pyramid immediately. We don't want to be thinking in terms of the leader principle, if you will. Das Führerprinzip, if I may use the language in which it fits best. There's too much thinking in terms of the Führer principle now. Who is going to be the president? This is supposed to be the be-all and the end-all of our political life. Wrong. The be-all and the end-all of political life in this country, as the Constitution makes clear, is self-government by the people. And the more of that government that takes place at the local level, and the less at the state, and the less at the national, the better. Because that's how you maintain control. If it's all going to be centralized in Michael Chertoff's office, Homeland Security is going to look like Czechoslovakia in 1950. If it's all going to be decentralized in state militias, then we're going to have something that looks a lot like what the Founding Fathers had in mind and the way they actually lived. So those are the choices. Now, getting people to take the action is always the problem, but I think if anyone who looks at this says, well, we got to do it from the top down, we got to have an umbrella solution, no, wrong. It can't be done that way. You can't organize enough people to do it. You have to start someplace and get it done in one place so that people will be convinced that it can be done and that the idea can be used elsewhere. It brings me back to the movie The Longest Day. You remember that movie?
Yes.
That's the World War II epic. Wayne and all the stars in it. Well, there's one scene, which I believe is correct, historically correct. Henry Fonda is playing Roosevelt, grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. And he's an assistant division commander, I guess, one-star brigadier general. And he lands with the 4th Division on Utah Beach. And he's sitting down there with some of his staff people, and they're consulting their maps, and his staff people are saying, you know, we've landed in the wrong place. This isn't where we should be. We're supposed to be a couple of miles somewhere else, another direction. What do we do? And Roosevelt says, we start the war from here. This is where we are. There's no changing it. We start the war from here. And this is the point I make in the book, and I make to anyone I talk to. We have to start the resurrection, the reformation, the revitalization, the restructuring. You use whatever word you want. We have to start that process for our country right where we are now, with what we have now. And what we don't have now is control of Congress or the presidency. Forget that. Barring the miracle of Ron Paul's election, we don't have that. But we do have the possibility in many states, New York isn't one of them, Massachusetts, California, you can write some of them off for now. But there are many states in which it is still possible for enough people to organize themselves to do what I am proposing, to bring this pillar of the Constitution back into operation. Then the genius of this system will reassert itself. Because I think self-government by the people is very much like the free market. It has a logic and a power all its own. And once something starts working in the marketplace, it simply spreads. No one has to have top-down control to have a good idea spread in the free market. And I don't think one has to have top-down control of the media or the Congress or the White House to have a good idea in the area of self-government spread, particularly when the alternative is now so stark. I don't think there's anyone in this country that doesn't look at this situation and say, my God, you know, Bush, the decider. Well, it's not Bush alone. The man has created with his cronies an institutional structure which will be handed to anyone who gets into the White House. Not that Ron Paul would use it, obviously not. He'd probably draw out the executive orders, etc.
Once the precedent is set, Bush went further than Clinton ever went before. Everyone pushes the envelope. The next one will always push the envelope further. I happen to think of the states that might be that first state. New Hampshire is not out of the realm of possibility. Do you believe there is time to recreate a militia in the states before the monster beast of tyranny takes total control?
We have no choice. There better be. We better make time. We better do it. We better use whatever time we have. Because the alternative is too bad to contemplate. You have no alternative here. Let me go back one step. This is ultimately the reason I think the Democrats are not pushing anything against Mr. Bush, is because they anticipate that their people are going to be in control of Congress and the White House in 2009, and they're perfectly happy to have all of this legislation, Patriot Act, Military Commissions Act, all of these executive orders, in their hands. They're not interested in us. They're interested in their power. If they were interested in us, they'd be getting this off the books now. And then, my God, we might even all vote for the Democrats in 2008, thanking them for what they did. They're not getting it off the books because they anticipate they want to use it. Now, in terms of the time sequence, I don't think there's a lot of time. You look at some of the Burmese. Remember, they used to have these road marks before you got to the store that sold Burmese. One road mark that's very interesting to me is the Security and Prosperity Partnership Plan for the beginning of the North American Union integration operation. And that, from what I've seen in the documentation that's at least out on the Internet, because obviously those folks don't send me the behind-the-scenes material, they're talking about 2009, 2010, when they get this first bureaucratic foundation that's arranged among the trade bureaucracies of Canada, Mexico, and the United States, all properly structured. Now, I think that North American Union is one of the great dangers that we're facing, because once they shift to a hemispheric level, legislative power or judicial power or executive power, whatever it is that they get there first, they will be attenuating to a great degree the ability of the American people to govern themselves, period, because now there's going to be this hemispheric whatever court or agency that will be dictating in some way to us. So I'm looking at 2010. I say, something's got to be there. I want something to be there. New Hampshire's a good state. I like New Hampshire for exactly the reason you suggested. By 2010.
The book is Constitutional Homeland Security, Volume 1, The Nation in Arms. Its author is our guest, Edwin Vieira, Jr. This has been an absolute pleasure. Do you have a website?
No, but most of my material is on newswithviews.com.
And how do people go about getting these books?
Constitutional Homeland Security is available on Amazon. Put in my name or put in Constitutional Homeland Security. I think this is the only book that actually comes up with that title.
It's very easily readily available at Amazon.com and, again, newswithviews.com. Dr. Vieira, I want to thank you very sincerely for taking the time. I think everybody listening has thoroughly enjoyed this, and I hope they've enjoyed listening to you as much as I have. And I hope to bring you back when Volume 2 is ready to go. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, and I hope to see you again.
Thank you for listening to this edition of The Voice of Freedom. Opinions expressed are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the views of Truth and Freedom Radio Networks, Freedom Broadcast Group Incorporated, or our sponsors. For more information about your freedoms and liberties, or to contact Brent, just log on to our website at www.freedomradio.us or call 1-888-385-3733. Join us next time for another lesson in liberty on The Voice of Freedom.
America, land of the free, right to life and liberty. Open your eyes and you will see that America is still the